From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. State Treasurer Dale Falwell has stirred up debate in the North Carolina healthcare community with his Clear Pricing Project. It targets the state health plan. You'll hear Falwell discuss the project. He explains how it will protect the health plan's long-term viability. North Carolina's Read to Achieve program for elementary school students came under attack recently on the floor of the State House of Representatives. You'll learn why. State lawmakers are debating the pros and cons of legalized smokable hemp. Hemp farmers are on one side of the debate, law enforcement officers on the other. And we'll discuss North Carolina's tax on illegal drugs. Yes, there's a tax on those drugs. It generates millions each year for the state revenue department. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
$896 million. That is how much more money the state put into its bank account than it anticipated it would for the fiscal year that ended June 30th. The surplus is one more piece of information about the state of North Carolina's finances that our next guest, Joe Coletti, is looking at to assess where we are and where we should go when it comes to spending and taxing. Joe, of course, is senior fellow with the John Locke Foundation. He joins us now. Joe, welcome back to the show.
Glad to be here.
Wow. Great news. $896 million we didn't think we were going to have. How'd that happen?
It is nice to be able to talk about positive news, so that's a good thing. And it's largely income taxes that we had the federal tax reforms, and that allowed more money to come into the state. And the economy did better than expected as well. So there's higher corporate income tax money, higher sales tax money. A portion of that may be due to the Wayfair, the internet sales tax that the Department of Revenue has decided that it can collect.
Because there was more sales tax collected.
There was more on that side. These numbers are about $230 million more than we expected than was expected in May. So $900 million more than originally budgeted, $230 million more just since the May estimate, which was based on April.
Didn't the Cooper administration at one point predict we were going to have a budget shortfall for the fiscal year?
Yeah, they were very concerned in 2017 when the first budget was passed, because we work on a biennium in North Carolina. So the first time that it was passed, Charlie Parruse, the budget director, was writing to everybody and saying that this is going to create a $600 million hole in the budget after 2 years. So $600 million hole, $900 million surplus in revenue. Yeah, we can do the math.
Just
that's about
$1.5
billion difference. It's, but you know, what's that between friends?
So $896 million, that means most likely a lot of different people are going to be saying, my agency or my constituents need that money for fill in the blank. What happens to that money?
Well, the money is currently just available.
So it
rolls over, right? It rolls over because that's from the last fiscal year. It rolls over to what's available this year. It was not in any of the budgets that were proposed originally. So that $250 million is additional money on top of that, that would likely then roll over to the following year. We saw this happen in previous years as well, when final collections came in, hundreds of million dollars more than expected in May, and that just built up the stockpile of unreserved cash balances. So that's where this normally goes. Given the circumstances of the budget this year, it's hard to know where that actually ends up.
Now, I know you're a big proponent of building up the rainy day reserve fund. So I suspect if you had your way, you'd take at least a chunk of that and put it away for bad times.
Always the best thing to do, whether it's personal money or state money, is if it's a one-time shock, save it.
So, Joe, it's been fascinating over the past several months as we have witnessed, and you have been writing a lot about at johnlock.org and carolinajournal.com, the debate over how much money we should spend in our new state budget. Should we or should we not borrow money to build schools? And there's been a real disagreement between legislative leaders and Governor Cooper. Give us a sense over what the two sides have essentially argued is the best course for North Carolina.
Right. So the legislature has gone with the it's better to save money approach that we just talked about, that they a couple of years ago created a state capital and infrastructure fund that would pay for capital expenses on an ongoing basis using cash and paying down the debt that North Carolina has already taken out. And Governor Cooper has said that in his first budget proposal, Charlie Parruse, the budget director who we talked about earlier, said this is a bad idea. The governor's proposal eliminated the SCIF, as it's called, the Capital Infrastructure Fund, and took about $230 million of that and put that down into appropriations on just general operating expenses. In that budget, they then borrowed $288 million. So it's pretty clear one-to-one that we want to spend today and borrow money for capital needs. And that's been the approach that the governor's taken throughout the budget process.
Is not exactly
spend more money today and borrow to make up for that difference on capital.
That really is in opposition to what we've seen from legislative leaders over the past number of years, where they've taken a much more restrained approach. Spending has grown, but at a very low level.
Yeah, spending from the legislature has grown slower than the governor in every budget that has been proposed from both sides, and with the SCIF there to pay for capital on an ongoing basis, instead of borrowing money, they're paying down debt. And the governor's idea is it's like if you were looking to buy a phone. You know, you could buy the top of the line iPhone for $1,000 and pay that with cash, or you could pay a portion of that in cash and use the rest of it because the phone's useless without all the subscriptions to Audible and right. and Netflix and everything else. Use some money for that. But then you take on this additional, you have the ongoing cost of your subscription, plus you're paying down the debt for what you borrowed for the phone. That's what the governor is looking to do instead of, whereas the legislature is saying, look, we have money, let's pay for the phone and worry about subscriptions separately with the money that we have left over.
In essence, Governor Cooper wants to spend today plus borrow. And of course, that means down the road, we're going to have to pay back the debt, the interest on that.
Right. And that becomes a real problem because the first thing in the Constitution that the state is supposed to spend is supposed to pay with its money is debt service. So the capital and interest on what has been borrowed in the past is the first thing that we have to do with
our money.
There's
no way you can not pay that.
That's not right. And everybody is very protective of our AAA bond rating, which is also part of that. And so the first thing we're going to take care of are debt holders in the future, which means that either the revenue has to grow, the economy has to grow, or you have to have new taxes, or you have to cut spending. And that's what the governor is creating the choices in the future for. And so if the economy does slow down, right, we're going to be back in a really bad position of cutting services, raising taxes, probably doing both. And it's going to look like this is just what we have to do. There's no choice, when really the choice is being made today that affects that future decision.
Joe, you mentioned something really important, and that is if the economy were to slow down. We know the economy is cyclical. It's going to happen at some point.
Right.
Talk a little bit about why you are such a stickler about this issue of putting money away for savings.
Well, for those of us who have lived in North Carolina for a while, we've been through periods of time when the economy has slowed down and when the governors and the legislature have gone and raised sales taxes by a half penny or a full penny, and meaning $1 billion is what about a penny is worth today. And that is the money that comes from the working people, and it's a tax increase at the worst possible time when we don't have money, right? We individuals don't have money. The government obviously doesn't have money. And so that's what, and So it's cutting on, it's cutting services and raising taxes at the worst time. And that's why we need to save money today so that we can smooth that out and be, and the government can provide the services that are needed when the economy slows down, which is when those services are needed, and without raising taxes on the rest of us.
And that's why I know, as I said earlier, you've got your eye on that $896 million. Joe, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment. Tired of fake news? Tired of reporters with political axes to grind? Well, you need to be reading Carolina Journal. Honest, uncompromising, old-school journalism you expect and you need. Even better, the monthly Carolina Journal is free to subscribers. Sign up at carolinajournal.com. You'll receive Carolina Journal newspaper in your mailbox each month. Investigations into government spending, revelations about boondoggles, who the powerful leaders are and what they're doing in your name and with your money. We shine the light on it all with the stories and angles other outlets barely cover. But there's a bonus. Our print newspaper is published monthly, but our daily news site gives you the latest news each and every day. Log on to carolinajournal.com once, twice, even three times a day. You won't be disappointed. It's fresh news. And if you'd like a heads up on the daily news, sign up for our daily email. Do that at carolinajournal.com. Carolina Journal, rigorous, unrelenting, old school journalism. We hold government accountable for you.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. It's hard to tell how much healthcare actually costs, but our next guest is trying to shine light on healthcare costs. It's an important task for State Treasurer Dale Falwell. That's because he oversees the state health plan for government workers and retirees. Welcome back to the program.
Well, thank you for having me so we can talk about more transparency and lower cost.
You are tackling this issue through the state health plan through something that's called the Clear Pricing Project. Before we get into the details of that, tell us why this is something that is important to anyone who's connected with the health plan.
Well, whether you're on the health plan or not, you're either on the plan or you're being asked to pay for the plan, because this affects all citizens of North Carolina that pay taxes in any way, shape, or form. The why is simply this. The state health plan, which is the largest purchaser of health care in North Carolina, has not been taking advantage of its buying power. The reason that is that the state health plan for years and decades have been in deals that, for lack of a better word, are secret contracts where no one knows the price and the value of what they're getting. And so what the Clear Pricing Project does is it brings transparency to health care. It pushes the control out to the consumer, and we are very confident that's going to allow us to lower costs for state employees and taxpayers like them who fund the plan.
Now, we're not going to get too far into the weeds, but one of the keys to this is basically you set reimbursement rates and say that this is what we're going to pay. It's not going to be something that will vary from place to place or time to time.
Sure.
This is going to be what we're going to pay.
It's called reference-based pricing. And the reason we went to reference-based pricing is we sent a records request to one of the largest hospitals in North Carolina, and this is what they returned to us. I'm thumbing through a 140-page document where every single part of the document is blacked out. And the fact is that as the state treasurer, we're spending over $3 billion a year of taxpayer and member money on something we don't know the price and the value of. So to get in the weeds, reference-based pricing is basically based on Medicare reimbursement rates, not Medicaid. We're going, on average, almost 100% over that. So almost double the Medicare reimbursement rates. To put that in context for your listeners, Mitch, prisoners, if they need medical attention in North Carolina, get services at 40% over Medicare. People, unfortunately, who are injured in workers' comp claims, the providers get reimbursed at 40% over Medicare. We're offering 100% over Medicare for the people who teach our kids, protect us from criminals, and pave our roads. We think it's very reasonable, and that's all we're doing with the Clear Pricing Project.
We are speaking with State Treasurer Dale Falwell about the Clear Pricing Project. Despite what sounds from what you were just saying, like, hey, good deal, there's been a lot of pushback. This has been a major political issue. Tell us about what you've been trying to do to overcome opposition to this.
Well, the first thing that we know that can help us overcome this is that every one of your listeners has their own story about healthcare cost. Surprise billing, out-of-network billing, people being sent to collections for healthcare costs. So everybody in North Carolina knows there's a problem with healthcare. And the big problem, to kind of sum it up, is that they don't consume healthcare in this state. It actually consumes them. In order to consume something, you have to know the value and the price of what you're getting. In healthcare, it's like going to a grocery store where there not being any prices on any of the products. They take a payment from you at the checkout, and then 4 months later, you get this bill in the mail that you don't understand. So the Clear Pricing Project, we're very honored that since we've launched this, we've had 27,000 providers of healthcare who have signed on the Clear Pricing Project across North Carolina. These are providers of healthcare. They want to be a part of open contracts, giving the control to the consumer and lowering cost. For this, you mentioned the word political. This is not political or mathematical or emotional for us. This is mathematical. The fact is that our healthcare and pharmaceutical costs are going up at a much faster rate than the appropriation coming in from the General Assembly. On top of that, which is North Carolina's insolvency of its state health plan, is right behind the state of Illinois. Same Illinois that your listeners have become familiar with as a state that's not in good shape. They should be asking themselves right now, how is it possible that our insolvency is right behind Illinois? And the fact is that we've been making promises for lifetime health, to be eligible for lifetime health care in many instances after 5 years and one day of service, and no money has ever been put aside for that. That's why we're spending all of our attention attacking this problem of runaway health care cost and secret contracts. And the people that are opposed to us are just attacking us.
You mentioned the 27,000 providers. There's still some key providers that have been holding out, fighting this. What efforts are underway now to try to get all the other important players on board?
Everything it takes and then some. You know, for a year, we've answered every phone call, every email. We've attended every meeting by any of these major providers. And basically, at the end of the day, they try to steer us into something else. You know, we're interested, after we figure out what we're supposed to pay, and I say that sort of sarcastically, you can't cut the cost of anything unless you know what it costs. And you can't value anything, whether it's the car you're driving today or the suit you're wearing. You can't value anything unless you know what it costs. So our strategy is this, reference-based pricing so that we can figure out what we're supposed to pay. Secondly, we're going bundling. Bundling is most associated right now with carpentry, which is knees, hips, and rotator cuffs. Bundling is where you go and you pay one price. It's for the titanium screws, the band-aids, the anesthesia, the physical therapy. People know exactly what they're getting when they go in and get their knee replacement. They know exactly what the total cost is going to be. The third factor is alternative payment arrangements, and then we'll see where we go from there. But the fact is the state, as keeper of the public purse, we're spending almost over $3 billion of taxpayer money, and we don't know what we're getting for it.
Is it fair to say that one of the reasons we're in the state that we're in right now is that the state health plan has basically been seen as somewhat of a cash cow by healthcare providers, that you know they might have to pay attention to what they're charging to other folks, but they've looked at the state health plan as a way to just make easy money?
We haven't been able to prove that, but sort of to your point, every string that we've pulled on over the last year regarding clear pricing, we've never gotten to the end of any of it. Because every time we think we're at the end of a string that we're pulling on, we find something else that we didn't know about it. If you take their words of the leaders of the hospital association who are fighting us about on clear pricing, if you take them at their word, one particular major medical center says that, and I hope this comes across on the radio, that we make up 4% of their business, and by cutting costs 10%, we're going to wipe out 40% of their profit. What other mathematical explanation is there for to your question than when you only make up 4% of somebody's business. And by cutting expenses, you're going to wipe out 40% of their profit, other than the fact the state health plan has been looked upon as a cash cow. For us not to be successful in clear pricing means more secret contracts and higher cost.
Well, we know one person who wants to see fewer secret contracts at lower costs and continue working on clear pricing project is our state treasurer, Dale Falwell. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation, and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Who knew you could shop and invest in freedom at the same time? It is true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate the John Locke Foundation to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop. Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. Here's how. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile is the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible Amazon Smile purchases to the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate us as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. North Carolina has struggled to improve public school students' reading skills. The Read to Achieve program addresses that goal. It aims for reading proficiency in the third grade. But State House Democratic Leader Darren Jackson recently blasted the program.
How much has been spent on Read to Achieve since it first passed? $150 million. So here are the facts of what we've gotten for that $150 million. Our third grade reading scores have dropped from 60.2% in 2013 to 55.9% in 2017-18. The drop in third grade reading scores over the time period is the biggest among all of the state's EOCs, or EOC exams. The drops in overall performance has been accompanied by a widening gap for black students between white and black. There's been no external evaluation of why these scores are falling in the first place. Could it be the teacher cuts starting in the recession when the Democrats were in control and we had to cut back? Could it be the cuts, the pre-K that we initiated in 2011 and 2012 as we start trying to pass tax cuts?
Republican State Representative Craig Horn of Union County responded to Jackson's criticism.
It's bothersome to all of us that we have spent $150 million. And based on news reports and data, we're not moving ahead. Now, some people would say, well, that's a reason to do nothing, to just go back to do things the way we did them before. Well, maybe so, but that's not for me. Failure should never be a deterrent to trying things. And I don't mean to get off the question, but my point is, in response to your question, that we need to take a deep dive, look seriously at the issue, and to engage everyone at every level, because we all of us, have a vested interest in this. We need to do a better job of teaching our teachers how to teach reading. We need to do a better job of teaching our kids how to read. I know it won't come as a surprise to anyone, but the kids of today aren't the kids that we were. We may think that they are a kid is a kid is a kid, but, you know, this is a different world. Part of it is because we have a bad habit of throwing money at problems rather than necessarily our best efforts at problems.
Lawmakers are moving forward with an Excellent Schools Act. It's designed to fix flaws in the existing Read to Achieve program. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
We're doubling down on freedom. At Carolina Journal Radio, we're proud to bring you stories that impact your life and your wallet. And now, get twice as much freedom when you also listen to our podcast, Headlock, available on iTunes and at johnlock.org/podcast. Now, Headlock is a little bit different. It's a no-holds-barred discussion that challenges soft-headed ideas from the left and the right. But like Carolina Journal Radio, Headlock is smart and timely. But with Headlock, you'll hear more about the culture wars, and you'll get some more humor as well. We guarantee great information and a good time. Double down with us. Listen to Carolina Journal Radio each week, and listen to Headlock, too. Remember, you can listen to Headlock at johnlock.org/podcast, or subscribe or download each week at iTunes. Carolina Journal Radio and Headlock, just what you need to stay informed and stay entertained. Both brought to you in the name of freedom by the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. State lawmakers are feuding over hemp, specifically smokable hemp. The debate revolves around outlawing the substance. A recent hearing brought attention to the issue. Mike Waters is district attorney for Franklin, Granville, Vance, and Warren counties.
Allowing smokable hemp is the de facto legalization of marijuana. It creates insurmountable barriers both in an enforcement level and then also at a court level as far as convicting persons that are in possession of marijuana. What you're essentially doing is asking a law enforcement officer to tell you the difference between a German Johnson tomato and a cherry tomato plant without the tomatoes on them. I mean, this is how difficult it is. We don't presently have the capability for a roadside test. And if we were to develop such, it's going to come at great expense and great cost for these local agencies that are already strapped. And so what it's going to mean is it's going to make it harder and harder for your law enforcement agencies to keep persons that are smoking marijuana from driving vehicles and from doing other nefarious activities. And I speak as someone who comes from a community where hemp is very important, and we have people growing it, and I am in full support of that. But I'm not in support of something that is going to create an insurmountable barrier for our law enforcement officers and for our people in charge of enforcing the laws of the state.
On the other side of the issue, Michael Sims. He owns a business called Charlotte CBD.
I want to make it very clear that we understand this makes it difficult for law enforcement. There is options. There are tests. There are roadside tests that are readily available. They're affordable. And we'd be glad in this hemp industry to pay for such tests with taxes from the products we sell. What you got to understand is these people we're talking about, we're taking this from, are our people. They're our veterans. They're our law enforcement. They're our first responders. There are a lot of people that take these products and come in our store to take these products, but cannot publicly say so because they're fear of losing their benefits, in fear of losing their jobs, in fear of being turned against by their fellow law enforcement officials and things. This is something that farmers are making a great deal of money on. My store pays no less than $400 a pound directly to the farmer, and sometimes upwards of $2,000 a pound. It is very profitable for the farmer. It is great for our state's economy. It is great for everything. There's a lot of benefit. This isn't just smokable hemp flower. This is extractable hemp flower. This is a flower that kills zero people, and it helps so many. We have people that come in from everything from PTSD to autism and everything else, and this is a slippery slope. If we start banning something that is federally legal, it doesn't stop there. It's going to go into the oils. It's going to go into the vapes and everything else that these people depend on to get through daily life. They depend on it to be active in the community, to be an active part of life. They have to have this, and they're getting off pharmaceutical pills at a record pace. Yesterday, they came out and they said 76,000 opioid pills, or excuse me, 76 billion opioid pills were prescribed between 2006 and 2012 alone. We have an epidemic in this country, and one of the big fighters in this epidemic we have is hemp and cannabis. We need this. It's happening nationwide.
Blake Butler is executive director of the North Carolina Industrial Hemp Association.
I understand that smokable hemp has put so many of you in a difficult situation, and I do respect that. Our association and all the industry stakeholders have acted in good faith. We've met with many of you. I've met with the SBI, with law enforcement, and we want to do the right thing. This program, this industry is important to all of us. But this new restrictive language, this amendment, will devastate the North Carolina hemp industry. We are currently a top five state in hemp. But I can tell you this, we're getting ready to get a lot of press for the wrong reasons, because I'm getting the calls. Amazingly enough, Tennessee, South Carolina, Virginia, they're figuring out smokable hemp. And what are we doing here? We're throwing our hands out and declaring to the rest of the nation, with all the technology in the world, we can't figure it out. A lot of you have told me that my people are causing problems by sending emails and phone calls. And I want to remind everybody in this room, these are not my people. These are our people. These are our farmers, our entrepreneurs and small business folks. These are our North Carolinians that have trusted this state for this new opportunity.
Industrial hemp farmer Frederica Martin explained her opposition to the ban on smokable hemp.
As a farmer, we have spent so much money on indoor growing. I have spent up to $100,000 to grow indoor to produce a flower smokable hemp. If you take that away from me and other farmers who have spent hundreds of thousands of dollars on greenhouses, what are we are supposed to do as farmers to recoup that money? We can't get insurance. The banks are messing with us because it's a product that no one wants to deal with. We got into this program because we were looking for a new opportunity to make money. If you take away smokable hemp, as a farmer, I don't know where we would go. I don't know what we would do. I don't know how we would pay our bills. So you're not just letting down people who own retail. You're letting down the farmer. You've got to listen to the farmer. You've got to hear our plight. We cannot find another crop here that will pay for all the debt we have inquired to produce this crop.
Fred Baggett represents the North Carolina Police Chiefs Association.
The law enforcement and prosecution community in North Carolina is unified in its message to you. And we feel like we are to provide you with information for you to make policy. And that information from all these elements is this. As long as smokable hemp is legal for sale and use in North Carolina, marijuana enforcement is virtually impossible. We only oppose one product that results from the growing of hemp. We're not against hemp farming or the other products, including CBD oil and other products. But smokable hemp in that form makes marijuana enforcement impossible.
Lawmakers themselves take very different approaches to the issue. Republican State Representative Jimmy Dixon supports a ban on smokable hemp.
I think we can overcome any of the obstacles that stand in our way of making hemp production a viable industry in North Carolina. But ladies and gentlemen, if we were going to make an error, if I could never error in a manner that could have such a disastrous effect on what situation this puts law enforcement in, not even to mention the detrimental effects of moving towards legalizing marijuana.
Democrat Kelly Alexander offers an opposing view.
Clearly, Representative Dixon and I have different perspectives on whether or not legalization of marijuana ultimately is going to bring on the apocalypse. I don't think it will. If we were to continue along this path with smokable hemp, what happens when law enforcement stops somebody that has an air freshener that smells like marijuana? Are we going to outlaw that next? If they have a body lotion that gives the aroma in the vehicle, are we going to outlaw that next?
You've been listening to highlights from debate over one of the most contentious issues in North Carolina's General Assembly this year, the future of smokable hemp. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Real influence. You either have it or you don't. And at the John Locke Foundation, we have it. You'll find our guiding principles in many of the Freedom Forward reforms of the past decade here in North Carolina. So while others talk or complain or name call, we provide research, solutions, and hope. Our team analyzes the pressing issues of the day, jobs, health care, education, and more. We look for effective ways to give you more freedom, more options, more control over your life. Our goal is to transform North Carolina into a growing, thriving economic powerhouse, the envy of every other state. Our research has helped policymakers make decisions that ensure you keep more of what you earn, expand your choice of schools for your kids, widen your job opportunities, improve your access to doctors. The recipe for stability and a bright future. For truth, for freedom, for the future of North Carolina. We are the John Locke Foundation. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. While we're accustomed to paying income tax, sales tax, maybe even property tax if you're a homeowner, but some North Carolinians may be subject to another kind of tax, a tax on their illegal drugs. Yes, it is true. We're not kidding. North Carolina imposes a tax on illegal drugs. And that is the subject of a new Carolina Journal column written by Brene Goforth. Brene is the newest member of the John Locke Foundation team. Brene, welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. This is your first chance to be with us. Hopefully, the first of many, many appearances on the show. Glad to have you.
Thank you for having me.
So how did you find out that North Carolina imposes a tax on illegal drugs?
Right. So I was writing a kind of brief from one of our researchers' pieces on the proposed hemp reforms. And so they're clarifying the status of hemp as not one of these unauthorized substances. And one of the things that was said just in passing was that it's no longer going to be subject to these unauthorized substance taxes. And I thought, wait a second, what are those? I need to know more about this. And so I did some research and I thought, oh my God, I have to write about this. This is so interesting.
And in fact, you did. And it's a really interesting column available at carolinajournal.com. So tell us about the tax. I mean, how much and how do they impose this?
Right. So the amount for the tax varies. And so the amount amount of each particular drug that you have to be subject to the tax varies as well. So for any kind of drug that's not measured by weight, it's 10 units of that drug. So say for something like Xanax, for something like moonshine, it's any amount of it makes you subject to this tax. And the way that it's supposed to work is it's based on how much of it you have. You go into a North Carolina Department of Revenue office and you say, hey, I'm here to buy a drug stamp. And this is how much drugs I have. Please, here's my money. Give me a stamp. And you're supposed to permanently affix it to your drugs, whatever that means.
Okay. So when we're saying illegal drugs, you mentioned a couple of them. Are we also talking things like meth, heroin, anything that's classified as against the law, not prescription medication, anything like that, but illegal drugs. So it really kind of boggles my mind to think that someone would walk into a state agency office and say, hi, I'm here to tell you that I am like a drug user or a drug dealer, and I want to be compliant with the state rules on taxes. That just sounds crazy, Brene.
Yeah, it does sound crazy. And, you know, drug dealers and drug users don't do that. They don't go into the North Carolina Department of Revenue office and ask for a stamp. Since the law was implemented in the 1990s, there have only been 109 orders for these stamps. And that's believed that most of those were from stamp collectors. So really? the way that the tax in reality is actually collected is after you get charged with a crime, you get your criminal penalties, you get whatever else, and then the NCDOR comes after you for back taxes. And so that is how most of this tax ends up being collected.
Now, that's a fascinating point because people who may not realize it because they're in the drug dealing business, for example. Once they are caught by the cops, they also get a tax bill?
Yes, they do. So there's actually three different ways that you can be fined for a drug crime. The first one is the criminal penalty from the crime that you did. The second is any civil asset forfeiture. So any of your assets that are associated with the crime, money from the crime, automobiles, the house that you stored your drugs in can be taken. And then there's this third thing, the unauthorized substance tax, which is a third fine that can be imposed on you. So there's lots of different ways that you could be liable to the government after you've committed one of these drug crimes.
Do we know how much money this actually brings in for the state?
Right. So it varies, but the numbers that we have are between $6 million and $11 million a year. So that's not chump change. It brings in a good amount of money.
That is really fascinating. I'm wondering if some of our listeners might be thinking, well, wait a second. This sounds so unusual. Do other states do this? Do we know that? Or has anyone tried to challenge this in court?
Right. So a couple of other states have tried to do this, and this is not the first unauthorized substance tax. The United States actually did this back in 1937. They imposed a drug tax on illicit substances, and it was struck down in the late 1960s because they found that it violated the Fifth Amendment self-incrimination clause. It required you to give up your criminal activity, and therefore it wasn't constitutional. Tennessee did as well, one of these taxes and found it unconstitutional. And North Carolina's tax originally didn't hold constitutional muster because the taxes were so high. The North Carolina Supreme Court said this fails the double jeopardy clause in the Constitution. You're essentially charging a person for the same crime twice.
Has anyone actually gone in and tried to go through the process just to experiment and say, I want to see how this actually works? I mean, you mentioned that there had been, I think it was 109 people who had applied for these types of unauthorized substance stamps, a lot of them stamp collectors, but do we have any personal experiences with this?
Yes. So just earlier this year, Jonathan Holbrook, who is a professor at the UNC School of Law, he went in to see if he could get one of these, if this was at all possible. And the answer is that North Carolina Department of Revenue offices do not carry these stamps. And so the way that you would have to get them is to mail in a form, which, of course, is not anonymity. That would be, you know, a form of self-incrimination there, because in order to get the stamps back through the mail, you'd have to provide a return address. And so that's not exactly anonymous.
It would kind of be like, hey, Mr. Police Officer, come and get me if you apply for these things, right?
Right. And Interestingly enough, they made it in the law. They tried to make it anonymous because the Department of Revenue, if anyone there discloses your purchase of a drug stamp to the police, they are guilty of a class one misdemeanor.
Really?
So yeah, that is supposed to keep it from, you know, being self-incrimination. But the United States Postal Service is not privy to that. So if you have to send it through the mail, you know, that's not a Department of Revenue officer who would be giving you up to the police.
Brené, you are of the millennial generation and the newest member of the John Locke Foundation team. By the way, we are glad to have you here at the John Locke Foundation. Does it surprise you as you look at tax policy that, and have you talked to people of your generation about what North Carolina is doing?
Yes, I have. Everybody that I've talked to about it is so surprised. This is something that nobody's heard of before from my generation. And it is something that crosses generational divides in that we have seen the negative effects of the war on drugs and how it has been less than effective, not as effective as we would have liked it to. And for the incentives to be pushed in this way that the police get 75% of the money that comes in from this tax, that kind of incentivizes them to go after these drug crimes, which have proven to be an ineffective way to end, you know, drugs in the United States, and to not go after maybe some sort of policing that would be better for the community.
It's a really fascinating article available at CarolinaJournal.com, written by Brené Goforth. Brené, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for the show this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll join us again next week for another edition of Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.